This is CliffCentral.com.
Today's Burning Platform, we'll chat in a moment or two to Ivo Fechter, who of course writes for a number of publications, including the Daily Maverick, and we'll chat to him. And then I saw, just for your interest, Adrian Groenewald, who is the host of the Leadership Platform, has tweeted out an interesting poll. I'd like to know how you feel about this. The problem, he says, of weak, toxic leadership is destroying our world, economically, politically, socially, morally, and health-wise. We need a greater and more coordinated effort to create awareness of authentic leaders and leadership, and then we need to get better at developing them. Do you agree or disagree? Go and vote on his poll on Twitter this morning. All right, well, we're going to talk about some of the stories in the news. You know the Burning Platform. It's the moment we have every week, all of us, to catch up on what's going on in the world. Justice Malala has moved to the United States, but he'll be back next month to join us for a special version of the Burning Platform, and he'll continue to make his contributions from the US. But we're going to talk to a number of South Africa's journalists and writers and figure out with them every week what the position is on so many important issues in the news. So I'm very pleased to welcome to the show this morning Ivo Fechter. Morning, Ivo. It's nice to talk to you again, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well, and yourself?
Good, good. Okay. Good. Don't worry, Cliff Gareth, it'll work with me.
Yeah. Mr. Cliff.
No, don't do that. Then I think I'm. Then I start thinking I'm important. So,
you are.
Ivo, what for you is more important at this stage? The ANC's fantastic promise to sort out pit toilets by 2030 as a show of their ambitious tasks and promises. The DA's constant umming and ahhing about BEE, or the EFF's continued coordinated attack on property ownership with Section 25 of the Constitution, which has of course been stolen from under them. The carpet's been pulled out from under them by the ANC, who've now made this their election promise for 2019. Of those three stories, which one is the most important?
Expropriation by far.
All right. Tell me what.
Not to say that the others aren't important.
No, sure.
But expropriation goes to some very, very fundamental rights that make a democracy work.
So let's start there, because it's obviously something that's preoccupied a lot of people. It's hit the economy quite hard, and that's before anything's actually happened. A lot of people are more concerned by Cyril Ramaphosa jumping the gun and saying that this is going to be our policy, this is going to be our intention, and it's the ANC's intention to make it policy, ahead of the public hearings being completed. So has Cyril shot himself in the foot here? Is this potentially a source of some kind of action in the courts?
Well, legally speaking, no. Look, he was speaking on a Tuesday, it was a very late July, I think 31st of July. Mm-hmm. He was speaking as the president of the ANC, right? Not the president of the country.
Is this like when someone puts on a different outfit and they go, ta-da, I'm now a man, and yesterday I was a woman? Is that what it is?
Yeah, pretty much. He obviously has two roles, right? He's president of the country, but he's also president of the organization, the ANC, the political party.
Yes.
Now, as a political party, the ANC has the same right as any other political party to take a public position on certain policies. Mm-hmm. You know, just the same right that the DA has to stand up and say, we are against expropriation and we will vote against it in Parliament.
Right.
The ANC has the right to say, well, we support it. And in fact, we are going to support an amendment to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So legally speaking, he was within his rights. There is obviously a question over why the president of the ANC would get such a nice little slot on the SABC and go on at 10 o'clock at night to address the nation.
Mm.
You know, I haven't seen Musi Maimane come on the SABC all that often to address the nation.
Well, perhaps we should count our blessings.
Well, true. Fair enough. you know, other than that, legally speaking, he was perfectly within his rights. Although it does undermine the process. You know, it undermines people's faith in the process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went to the hearings in Oudtshoorn the very next day, and someone said, one of the representatives of the Khoi people said, that the announcement of the president is actually an insult. It is not acceptable before the process is completed. And someone else said, what are we doing here then? So it certainly undermines the process and people's faith in the public consultation process.
Yeah, well, it seems also that these hearings have been a bit of a farce. I mean, a lot of it has just been people who've been bussed in by the EFF, and maybe we've got to give them credit for having actually coordinated and organized an incredible campaign in terms of making their presence felt at these hearings. But it certainly hasn't given us an accurate reading of how many people feel about very basic things like property rights.
No, it's a bit like an internet poll. You firstly, you're only asking people who actually see the poll. Secondly, there's a self-selection bias in people who can be bothered to answer the poll, mm-hmm. which are usually only people who feel strongly about it one way or another. The in Swellendam, I also attended a hearing, and I spoke to the mayor of Swellendam, and he said that the number of people who voted EFF in the most recent local election in Swellendam was 40.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then he pointed to the several hundred EFF supporters that were sitting in the hall there. You know, and he said, look, these guys are not from the Swellendam region.
Right.
You know, they're not from here. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think you do get a sort of distorted picture of what people believe. But besides for that, this goes to a much bigger question, I think. You know, if you ask a whole bunch of poor people, right, and a lot of these things were held in out-of-the-way towns and so on, you know, in the Eastern Cape, it was held in Janssenville, not in PE.
Yeah.
If you're going to ask a whole bunch of poor people, look, there are a few rich people, you have nothing, should we take their land and give it to you?
Of course they're going to say you yes. Know?
What answer do you expect?
It's like if you ask me to go to a dinner where Bill Gates is going to give me half his money, I'll say, sure, I'll be there.
Yeah, no, indeed. I mean, it's a classic case of two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for lunch.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Which is often attributed to Benjamin Franklin. It wasn't him that said it. And often people add a little line, which I thought was quite funny. Liberty is a well-armed lamb contesting the vote.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. So these hearings that you've experienced, I mean, what kind of things get said at these hearings? What sorts of comments are made, and what kind of real concerns, and what kind of emotive roaring and screaming is heard from people who really are just feeling completely left out of the economy, let alone society?
Well, look, the thing is, you know, you do have to feel a lot of empathy with, you know, a lot of the speakers that were in favor of expropriation. Mm-hmm. You know, they tell stories of you know, very hard scrabble lives as farm workers, that they don't have any rights,
yeah.
That when the husband dies who's a farm worker, then the wife and kids get kicked off the farm. You know, they're really some horrible stories. I mean, the Khoi people in particular, that was an interesting one in Oudtshoorn, where they said, look, they were expropriated long before 1913. You know, and all of the land around sort of the Western Cape area, the Karoo area, really belongs to them.
Yeah.
And they never have been heard. You know, they weren't heard under apartheid. They weren't white enough. And now under ANC rule, they're not being heard either. They're not black enough. They consider the black tribes just as much invaders as the white colonialists were.
That's interesting. Yeah. And this self-appointed, it appears self-appointed, king of the Khoi that's been making a lot of noise lately. What's the story there?
Yes, Cornelius. Well, he's been banging on for a while now about wanting to secede. Mm. Nobody's, I don't think, even acknowledged his declarations of secession. And there's really no practical reason or practical way in which he's going to enforce a secession.
Yeah. But this question of secession, before we get onto Cornelius, mm-hmm. is it possible that there is a little bit of you know, it's really kind of smoke and mirrors, because what's the idea of South Africa? South Africa was really constituted by the British Empire back in the early 1900s, and our borders were drawn very randomly by a rough idea of what they thought the geographical features that might demarcate that border should be, rather than that there were Tswana people north and south of the Botswana-South Africa border, and that it didn't really separate them along any kind of identifiable ethnic or cultural or, you know, political.
No, there were no real rational. I mean, look, some of them do have a historical basis. You know, you think the Western Cape and when they were fighting the old Transvaal Republic and the Free State Republic. So there was some sort of justification for the borders then. But no, the provincial borders certainly don't reflect any sort of cultural or ethnic groupings in modern South Africa.
I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting that the government opened up a can of worms here, and I'm not sure they entirely foresaw that people like King Godwill Zwelithini and, you know, the Western Cape Secession Party or whoever they are, and some other interest groups are suddenly saying, yeah, sure, we'll go with that, but then we're going to secede. You can have what's left, which doesn't really leave much of South Africa. I mean, if the Zulu King, and he has a pretty good claim on, you know, a cultural and ethnic identity.
He probably has the best claim of all, yes.
That's right. And he could very easily say, well, fine, so, you know, the Republic of KwaZulu-Natal, we've got a port in Durban, we've got some arable land, large tracts of very arable land. We've got a huge population of people who are quite ethnically, let's say, monotone. So he has a pretty good reason to show them this trump card if they do decide to go with EWC.
Yes, I mean, that's if you believe in the whole notion of ethnic identity and national identity group identity.
Let's just call it self-determination, which became an ugly word when Oranje started using it, but it's more or less the same thing.
Yes, exactly. Just as an aside, you don't need all those wonderful things, arable land and mineral deposits and you might need a port. Mm. But, you know, if you look at Hong Kong and Singapore and so on, those are countries that have pretty much nothing except a port.
Okay.
If you look at Holland, you know, which goes centuries back, it's a tiny little country with very little by way of farming and natural resources. They're built entirely on commerce, and they got built a very wealthy country just out of commerce. Well, so you don't really need
Singapore. Singapore is a 100-year-old city, and there was nothing there before. It was another fishing village, and look at it now.
Exactly, you know, and they can be perfectly rich and prosperous and well off without any of the natural resources that you would normally associate with an entire country. When you go back to the negotiations for South Africa.
Hang on, I just want to play quickly on this fantasy. So let's imagine King Goodwill does secede and KwaZulu-Natal is declared a separate sovereign state. If he, for example, said, well, he's going to lower taxes in KZN, he'll put them at 20% or 10%, you know, the top bracket. He only wants 10%. Or let's say there was only a transaction tax or whatever. You think that would mean for a lot of people that it would be worth moving to KZN?
It could do if he indeed recognizes property rights.
Yeah.
And that really is the fundamental thing, right? As long as he respects property rights, right, and then makes an attractive investment destination, then he could very well create himself, you know, a little Zulu tiger, if you like.
That would be fascinating. I mean, I know I'm being facile here, but, you know, he does care about his property rights. We just don't know whether he cares about anyone else's.
Oh, well, we know for sure that he doesn't care about anyone else's because he wants to keep people in bondage, effectively, on tribal land.
Right. They never get property deeds.
Which is really a feudal sort of system. You know, people are peasants on the land, mm-hmm. and the tribal authority owns the land.
All right, so back to your question around the designation of South Africa's borders.
Yeah, you know, I think if you go back to the old the negotiations for a new South Africa, there was a lot of talk about whether or not the Afrikaners could get an independent homeland, right? And there was reasonable grounds for them to argue for that. You know, they didn't feel integrated with the rest of the country, and they felt like a national sort of a separate. They felt a separate identity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not unusual internationally for groups like that. You know, if you think of the Catalans in Spain and so on, for groups like that to want a separate homeland. But any proposal to carve out an actual homeland, right, turned out to be fairly irrational. Either it basically captured the major cities and captured most of the resources and would leave the rest of South Africa with nothing, or it was just an unviable sort of country on its own. You know, it would be a landlocked thing in the middle of the Karoo. We really almost as a country agreed that no, we were not going to do that, right? Instead, we were going to integrate, right? We were going to do away with racism and we were going to integrate. And that really, I think, is still the policy that South Africa should proceed on. The old non-racial idea of sort of national unity. In that sort of space, there's no real space for secession. You know, if you think of seceding the Western Cape, well, yeah, sure, but what happens to all the causes in the Western Cape? Are they going to feel at home? Are they going to feel part of the secession?
No.
You know, I mean, would I be? I live in the Western Cape. Would I be happy with seceding from the rest of South Africa
No.
when Gauteng actually accounts for most of our GDP?
I think it's very complicated because although geography is probably at a point in human history and the human experience where it matters less than ever, it still does have a huge effect on, and we're still so material. Like, we need to know which river marks the end of our territory. We need to know these things. And this is about South Africa's property. So it's interesting that we're talking about individual property rights in a context where we're actually meant to be talking about what South Africa's property is.
No, I disagree. I think we should be talking about individual property
No, no, no,
rights.
I'm with you. I'm with you. But it's interesting that also, as a part of this discussion, we would have to look at an inventory of what this country actually has and doesn't have. And at this point, it looks like our balance sheet, based on, economic growth, which is slightly sour, is not looking particularly favorable.
No, it's not. I want to actually try and get to if we can go back to the fundamental importance of property rights. I
Yes,
think
let's.
because people kind of misunderstand that. If you go back to the policy ideas, land redistribution and land restitution, right? There's absolutely no question that restitution is just and that restitution can proceed according to the Constitution as it stands,
Right.
right? There's if you can show that your land was taken away, then absolutely it needs to be returned to you, or you need to be compensated. And it's perfectly justifiable. It's the same way that you would go to court if someone defrauded you or stole from you.
Right.
So there's absolutely no question that that is a justifiable policy. Redistribution is also justifiable just on the basis of historical expropriation and historical injustice. Black people were not allowed to buy property from white people as of 1913.
Right.
It was simply illegal for them to do so, which led to the whole Bantustan setup that we had under apartheid South Africa, right? And it's absolutely important that we undo that. But again, that can be done under the current constitution. But people wonder why property rights are that important. Malema wants to vest property rights in the government. He wants all land to be owned by the government. The government already owns all mineral rights.
Yes.
On the very pretty much the same principle. The government owns the mineral rights. You get to lease it from the government. The government gets to decide what you do with it, right? And if you lease it from the government and you don't mine it, then they'll withdraw your lease and they will give it to the next guy who says he will mine it.
Right.
So now they have these public consultations, right? And the idea seems to be to get some sort of democratic mandate for property expropriation. Right. Now, on one side, the whole thing kind of failed in a way because the ANC received about 2,700 comments during this consultation process.
Right.
There were about 24,000 participants in total. Now, of those, fair enough, a majority wanted property expropriation without compensation. They couldn't always give good rational reasons for it. There were very, very much emotive appeals, to history and injustice and so forth.
Right.
But they were in favor of expropriation without compensation. What the ANC didn't take into account is that there are 700,000
written submissions. Yeah.
Right. So this is far, far more, orders of magnitude more, than they received during the public consultation process. The ANC, apparently, according to a report in the rapport, is now very upset about this and, you know, yelling at the branches that they should have focused on written submissions instead of getting people to the public hearings. And then there's now talk of wanting to reopen the process, which the Constitutional Review Committee has said they're not doing because that would undermine the process. But besides for that, you know, if you go to the whole idea of democracy, right, democracy is basically the right to decide who governs you. Right? It's not to decide what that government necessarily does. Right? Mm. Ludwig von Mises said, men are not infallible. They err very often. Right? It is not true that the masses are always right.
Yes.
And know the means for attaining the ends aimed at.
Right.
Belief in the common man is no better founded than was belief in the supernatural gifts of kings, priests, and noblemen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It cannot prevent majorities from falling victim to erroneous ideas and from adopting inappropriate policies, which not only fail to realize the ends aimed at, but result in disaster.
Right.
Majorities, too, may err and destroy our civilization. So the idea here is that although you have the right, an absolute right, and it's a very important right, to decide who governs you, right, that government needs to act rationally, right, in a way that the common man maybe doesn't know how to act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not everyone knows how to run a country.
No.
Not everyone understands economics. Right? In fact, every one of the people almost every one of the people that spoke at these public hearings, right, had no real clue about economics and the economic importance.
It stands to reason. I mean, that's probably why. Right. That's probably why some of them are poor. I'm not saying that that's the only reason, but it's possibly a reason why some of them are poor because they don't know how the economy works.
Yes. No. Indeed.
It's a cruel thing to say, but it's true.
A lot of people said that, you know, oh, if only they had a piece of land, they wouldn't be so poor. You know, and they could farm a few vegetables and keep a few cows, and then they wouldn't be poor, and the country wouldn't be poor. Thinking, well, actually, if you did that with everyone and everyone had a couple of cows and a vegetable patch, the country would be dirt poor.
Yeah.
Right? We'd look like Cambodia or Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then what you need to take into account is that democracy doesn't stand alone.
Yeah.
Right. As far back as Aristotle, he wrote that the basis of a democracy or a democratic state is liberty. Now, liberty is the absence of control exerted by a governing class, right? Whether they're a majority or a minority, you know, whether they're kings or democracy, right? It's the freedom to act individually, right? Limited only by recognizing the same freedom of everyone else.
Right. So in other words, you know, the limits of my independence and individual sovereignty are only determined by the limits of yours. And if we bump into each other, that's where they end.
Yes, indeed.
Right.
Right. I can't infringe on your liberties. Right?
Correct.
And the only way that I can act against you and your property is by voluntary agreement.
Yes.
Right. On both sides.
Right.
And to set out those freedoms requires the rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
Right, which in a democracy, everyone, including the government, must be subject to.
Right.
Right. So democracy is never absolute. Right. It doesn't mean that the majority gets to decide every single policy.
No. Well, that would be a tyranny of the majority, not a democracy.
No. No. Indeed. You know, you can't democratically decide that it's okay to enslave, say, the Afrikaner people.
Yeah.
Right. They might be in a minority, and they might be pretty good workers. And it might benefit the rest of us, but it would be wrong, outright. You know, a majority can't agree that it's okay to murder people sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, we had this very situation, and we hold it up as a great example of how sometimes the majority don't know what's good for them. When we talk about State versus Makwanyane, and we talk about how the Constitutional Court said, look, I know that you bloodthirsty bastards out there want the death penalty, but actually, according to our Constitution, the death penalty is not the way for civilized people to behave when we catch criminals. So they did what a constitutional court is meant to do, and the government backed them, and they decided to scrap the death penalty. And a lot of people are still kicking and screaming about that, but in the end, it's probably the right decision, because according to the dictates of our constitution, we're not the kind of country that gives the state the authority to kill someone.
Well, I mean, the state is that there's to protect life and liberty and property.
Correct. Right. So that was an example.
We'll get to property now.
I see you drawing the parallels. But
the state is there to protect life, right? Then how can you grant the state the right to kill people?
Absolutely.
You know, this should be something that happens only in really exceptional circumstances. Mm-hmm. A defense of war comes to mind. Mm-hmm. You know, but this is not something that you ordinarily want to a power that you ordinarily want to grant the state, because once you grant that to the state, well, how are they going to abuse it?
Well, they always will. History is a great source of information on this.
No, well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, if you there's a quotation, and I really can't find it now, so I'm not sure who said it, but that you should really evaluate every law and policy or every power that you grant the state. You need to evaluate on the basis of how your worst enemy would use that power. Mm-hmm. So if with expropriation, for example, right, yeah, how would a John Foster use that power? Mm. Right? Would you be okay with the state having the power to expropriate without compensation, right, if Julius Malema could come to power?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or if Adolf Hitler could come to power?
Right.
You know, that is what your Bill of Rights is supposed to do, is to protect you, right, from government, no matter who that government is.
Yes, I think that's a very important point, and I'm glad that you've, you know, by means of this explanation, made it very clear, I think, to people who are unsure of what they do and don't know about this, that it's actually a much more important issue. It comes down to our understanding of liberty, and our relationship with the state, far more than it is about things, about articles, about, you know, a ruling class or a capitalist economy or any of that stuff. This is far more pragmatic and real world.
It's a philosophical basis. You know, I wrote a piece a while ago on the farce of public consultations, and I quoted a bunch of sort of philosophical thinkers of the past, and, you know, to establish where do property rights really fit into the Bill of Rights. I mean, Your Bill of Rights, should that be limited to, you know, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, you know, freedom to vote for your government, etc.? Or does a property right really belong in that Bill of Rights? Right? Now, once you start thinking about it, property rights not only belong in the Bill of Rights, property rights can actually, you can almost reduce every other right, mm-hmm, to a property right. Right? If you go back to John Locke, he says, man has property in his own person. Right now, this is something that nobody else has any right to. The labor of his body and the work of his hands, we may say, are strictly his. Right? Every man is naturally free. Mm-hmm. Nothing can make him the subject of any earthly power except his own consent. Right? Yes. So the great and chief purpose of men's uniting into commonwealths and putting themselves under government is the preservation of their property.
Hmm.
And their property right derives directly from the fact that you own yourself. If you can't own your property, if you can't own what you produced, right, the fruit of your labor, right, then effectively I can enslave you, which means that you no longer own yourself.
Yeah.
That is how fundamental the property right really is.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting quote from John Locke. I wonder how many people though think that John Locke is not the kind of person to listen to in a modern democracy, because there are lots of people who would quote from various other sources that are probably a lot more nefarious and a lot less liberal leaning. But I think those words ring true. I certainly think I'm of the opinion that you own your own meat, you know. You should be able to exercise just about any decision about what you do with your body and your person, as long as, again, you don't in any way impinge on other people's rights.
No, indeed. No, I mean, that means that the right to property, you can't abrogate that by democratic process, right? Any more than you can abrogate the right to life or right. the right to bodily integrity.
Absolutely. Can you imagine if we give discretion to government about things like the right to life? It would be a dangerous world. It would be a very dangerous world because then government would draw up all kinds of spreadsheets about what life should be valued how. And the Chinese government are doing this at the moment with something called social capital. They're trying to give people a certain value, a certain number value on a chart, and depending on where you fit into that, you get more or less rights.
And that'll end up in courts. You know, someone assaults someone else, and the court will then decide, okay, well, what was their relative social status?
Correct.
Right. Is the person who was assaulted, are they insignificant and not very patriotic, and therefore we don't really care about them? Therefore, the guy's going to just get off with a slap on the wrist.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Or they're going to treat every assault as if everyone was in fact equal, and that's really, you know, the very important part. You can't just selectively abrogate human rights, and property is a fundamental human right.
Yeah, I'm curious about something you wrote just I think it was yesterday about plastic bags. Can we just change to that for a second, because this property thing is fascinating.
Sure.
We could probably talk about it all day, but I don't know if it's everybody's cup of tea. It's certainly important. But plastic bags, you've said if you want to save the planet, you should choose plastic shopping bags.
Yes, indeed.
Are you just trying to be controversial, or is there something you've done research-wise around this?
No, I was just trying to be controversial. It's absolute bullshit.
All right, tell me.
Okay, now, you know, everyone's agitating for, changing back to paper bags or using reusable canvas tote bags,
right.
etc.
And we're not allowed to use straws anymore.
Oh, yeah, and we can't use straws. Oh, don't get me started on straws. The short version of that is that it'll make such an insignificant difference, right? That worrying about it is really completely pointless. Mm-hmm. And I can quote you the statistics on how insignificant straws really are in the big scheme of things, right? And I've always felt that if you want to do something for the environment, then do something that actually has a significant impact. Don't all these little things that you can do at home, frankly, amount to nothing in the big scheme of things when you look at the percentages of where the rubbish comes from and where it goes. How much of our waste gets into the ocean? Well, it's 2-3% of our plastic waste ends up in the ocean. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of the plastic waste in the ocean is actually abandoned fishing gear. So if you want to do something about waste in the ocean, right, then deal with the fishing industry and abandoned fishing gear.
Wow.
That's where you can make a really big difference.
So our focus is just in a completely awful area. It's a pointless endeavor when there are much bigger fish to fry, so to speak.
No, exactly. And everyone goes around virtue signaling and, you know, putting up, oh, we don't like straws. And they put the sign up above their huge trays of plastic cutlery.
Yeah, I know. I think it's pretty ironic.
It's totally absurd. But, it's interesting that... the idea of plastic bags and whether or not plastic bags should be taxed, mm-hmm. or charged for, or B, should be banned altogether, right, has been studied on a number of occasions. And pretty much all of those studies find that plastic bags are, in fact, more environmentally friendly, have a lower environmental footprint than any of the alternatives. Than paper bags, than reusable tote bags.
Really?
There's a study recently done in Denmark, which came out earlier this year. Right. They said if you use a paper bag, right, you would have to use it 43 times, right, to reach the same environmental impact, the same low environmental impact, right, as a single-use plastic shopping bag that you then reuse as a plastic bin liner.
Wow. Right.
That's it. They also said reuse it as a bin liner and throw it away. That is better than recycling the bag.
Wow.
For the environment. Now, that's only 43 times. You try and use a paper bag 43 times.
No, it can't be done.
Try to pack your meat into it and see what it looks like after your 43rd use.
Oof, yeah, I got you.
Right. Now, a composite tote bag, which is made of jute, polypropylene, and cotton, which presumably is a common thing in Denmark, right? You'd have to use that 870 times, right, to match the environmental footprint of plastic bags.
My God.
If you want a pure cotton bag,
yes,
right, because, you know, pure cotton is where it's at,
sure,
right, you'd have to reuse it 7,100 times.
This is getting worse and worse for these activists.
All right. But, you know, the really, really good people, right, the ones who really care about the environment, they want an organic cotton bag.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
You'd have to use your organic cotton shopping bag 20,000 times, right, before the environmental footprint is as low as the good old-fashioned plastic shopping bag.
That's ridiculous.
Right? So if you go shopping every single day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, right, you'd have to make that bag last 55 years.
Most people don't shop every day and they don't do it for 55 years.
No, besides, wow, after a few weeks, that bag is going to get all grungy and you've got
horrible
material contamination concerns.
Sure.
You need to wash it, which wasn't even taken into account in the environment.
And of course,
footprint.
The washing thing, yeah, that has its own environmental problems.
Exactly, and that wasn't even counted here.
You see, the
more... this basically evaluated everything from the production, the extraction of the resources to produce these things, you know, the actual manufacture process, through to their final disposal process, whether it's disposal or recycling. Right.
You know, I get in here in the mornings and I think, oh, I'm going to learn some interesting things from one or two of our guests about politics or about this or about that. And then I end up learning that these cotton bags are a waste of time and it's a total joke. It's nonsense. So
yeah,
you're teaching me new things.
You are not being more environmentally friendly. Although they are very good for virtue signaling.
Right. Yeah, no. They make people feel better when they go to the shops. They can show other people that they've got them. Yeah. And there's
absolutely
no, there's no value we can attach to that.
And look, now the Danish numbers were pretty extreme. Other studies have found far lower numbers, far lower reuse numbers. But all of them have been consistent in saying that ordinary plastic shopping bags are, in fact, better for the environment than paper bags or cotton tote bags.
Right.
So they all agree in that. They don't agree. I mean, there was a study here in the UK which said that cotton bags had to be reused 131 times to match a plastic bag. So that's still 4 months worth of cotton bag use. You know, and if you go shopping, that's every day. If you use it every day, that's 4 months worth. I mean, is your cotton bag even going to last that long?
No, absolutely not. You make very good points, you see? I'm glad that we had you on this morning. Now, Ivo, before we say goodbye, I do want to have your comments on something that Gwen and Gwenya of the DA said yesterday. The DA, obviously, you know, between pillar and post, this Patricia de Lille thing has obviously had a lot of, you know, it's done a lot of damage to what's going on inside and what the perception of the DA is on the outside. They can't make their mind up about BEE. They don't seem to be standing up for property rights the way that we expect them to, certainly not these public hearings. But then Gwen Gwenya, who's quite new to the DA and was at the Institute for Race Relations before that,
yes,
she said something interesting, and I thought I'd ask you what your comments are on this. She said in a tweet yesterday, all major parties get given stick by the media. But the important difference is an attack on the ANC is mostly based on failures in government, criminal offences, etc. Attacks on the DA are largely ideological. One is attacked because of what it has done. The other is attacked because of who it is. What do you think of that?
Look, I have great respect for Gwen and Gwenya, and if she's allowed to, I think she'll do great things for the DA. But I think that is total rubbish.
Okay.
A lot of the attacks on the ANC are purely ideological. You know, it's based on the fact that they're socialists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of ideological attack or stick that the ANC gets. Now, yes, they also get stick for failing in government, right? And as any government should do, right? But then that's equally true for the DA. You know, I mean, I live in Knysna. The DA is in charge here.
Yes.
The town is a mess. The DA gets a lot of stick for that. You know, there are protests almost every day over this thing or that thing or the other thing. In Cape Town, you know, the DA got a lot of stick over its management of the water crisis there. Right? The DA got a lot of stick over how it handled the DeLille case.
Yeah.
There are corruption issues that the DA gets stick over. They get stick over, you know, very practical issues of government around housing development and how they use government land. Right? Now they might have defenses for some of those things. Right? In some cases, for example, a lot of the available land belongs to national government, and the national government won't give it up. But to say that they only get stick because of who they are, rather than over their government failures, I don't think that's right. I think it's both.
Hmm.
You know, yes, they get stick over their ideology. A lot of people disagree with their ideology, disagree mm-hmm. with liberalism, mm-hmm. and disagree with free market, free enterprise, which is what the DA nominally at least supports. But they absolutely get stick over the way they govern, you know. And I mean, it goes back to one of my old things, you know, I dislike government in general, and I think government should be, you know, small and with very minimal purpose. They need to exist to protect life, liberty, and property, and that's pretty much it. Because no government is particularly good, you know, and I don't think that the DA will be all that much better than the ANC once they come to power.
Yeah.
You know, there's just as much risk of corruption, just as much risk of mismanagement, of lack of service delivery, and so on. I don't think that the DA is in any way special.
All right. Well, Ivo, that's all we got time for this morning, but thank you. It's always nice to talk to you, and thanks for filling us in on some of the basic principles of property rights and kind of, you know, the idea of what you own, what you are, what you can have, and what the government's not allowed to touch. I thought that was pretty useful. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right.
Absolute pleasure.
Ivo Fechter, everybody. You can catch up with him in his regular columns in, among other things, the Daily Maverick, and you can also find out more about him by following him on Twitter. It's useful to have a whole lot of inputs. And we, of course, will have Justice Malala from time to time on the Burning Platform, so don't worry, he hasn't gone away completely. He's just moved to another country, and it is a globalized world where Skype can connect you like that. I mean, Ivo was just in Knysna. So there he is, columnist on liberty and free markets, defender of the innocent, he says, debunker of myths, not for sale, Ivo Fechter. Follow him on Twitter. That is The Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. And we'll have more and more interesting guests over the next couple of weeks to help us figure out where in the world we fit in, what's going on in South Africa's politics, what's going on in the economy. And we'll try to get the smartest people in the room so that they can address the rest of us and make us the next smartest people in the room, whichever room we go into. I think that's the point. What did I say yesterday about where we're going at cliffcentral.com? The more you listen, the more you'll know.
This is cliffcentral.com.